Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week and next, we National Alliance members celebrate the birth of our founder, the late Dr. William Luther Pierce, whose life began on 11 September 1933, and whose mission continues to this very day in the growing success and growing force of our racial community. On this broadcast, we are going to give you a sneak peek at the audio project I've been working on for the last several months, Volume 10 in our CD series of Dr. Pierce's best speeches, The Power of Truth. We present today a portion of one of those speeches, an extract of his speech, An Awakening. An Awakening is unique in that, one, it is one of William Pierce's last speeches, and two, in it he discusses the very beginnings of his relentless efforts to save his people, our people, from Jewish domination, and the certain extinction that will be a consequence of that domination if we do nothing. A task that consumed all his waking hours for most of his adult life. These are the words of William Luther Pierce. Listen.
For 35 years, I have devoted nearly all of my waking hours to an effort to inform and inspire white Americans and other Europeans around the world. I began in 1966 by publishing and distributing leaflets and pamphlets and tabloid newspapers in Washington. My basic message then was the same as it is now. One part of that message is that the Jews are our misfortune. We made the terrible mistake of letting them infiltrate our society in America and in Europe. They began taking over our mass media of news and entertainment as soon as they stepped off the boat. In the early years of the last century, they headed straight for Hollywood and, working together, elbowed nearly all of their non-Jewish competitors out of the movie business. In New York and Washington, they seized control of the nation's most influential newspapers and magazines. In every country in Europe, they organized communist parties based on the political theories of their fellow Jew, Marx, and they fomented wars and revolutions aimed at destabilizing Gentile societies so that they could gain more power, more control. In Russia, in 1917, they finally succeeded in toppling a Gentile government and imposing their will on an entire Gentile nation. And then they selectively murdered tens of millions of Russians and Ukrainians. After the start of the Second World War, they continued their murder campaign in the Baltic states and in Poland, selectively rounding up and killing the best people, the most successful people, the most intelligent and creative and active people. They attempted to decapitate every Gentile nation they could to eliminate opposition to their rule. In 1966, I began publishing information about the Jewish role in communism and about the terrible crimes they committed against our people in Europe. In 1968, I published the first edition of my documentary article on the Jewish control of the news and entertainment media in America, naming the key Jews and explaining how they use their media control. It's called Who Rules America, and I've updated it and republished it nearly every year since then. I've explained over and over and over again for more than 30 years how Jewish media control has led to the total corruption of our political process and our government. The politician who gets the most votes wins a position at the public trough. The opinions of the majority of the voters and their attitudes toward political candidates are manipulated by the mass media, and the Jews control the mass media. I've pointed out the Jewish role in dozens of destructive governmental policies in the United States. Immigration policy, for example. In the 1950s and 1960s, the Jews pushed for switching the flow of immigrants into the United States from Europe to the Third World. They pushed for fewer white immigrants and more brown and black and yellow immigrants. And after they succeeded in that, they pushed for keeping our borders open to the Third World, resulting in the continued racial darkening of America. And among themselves, they talked about why this was important to them. They talked about the need to dilute the European majority in America in order to make America easier to control. They used their old tactic of divide and rule. And I've talked about the Jewish role in changing the standards in American education, about the Jewish role in pushing for racial mixing in our society and for more miscegenation between whites and non-whites. I've talked about the Jewish role in hate crime and speech crime legislation and about the Jewish role in attempting to abolish the Second Amendment. But Jewish media control and Jewish communism and the Jewish role in the destructive governmental policies that have afflicted America are not my whole message. They are just a part of it. I also have been talking and writing for decades about our own people's non-resistance to the Jewish evil inflicted on them. I've talked about our own people's collaboration in the Jews' destruction of America and our people. It wasn't long after I'd started writing and preaching to the public that I began to understand that most of the public is completely impervious to any message that doesn't come to them through TV. The only thoughts they permit into their heads are thoughts that they believe are in the heads of their peers. These are the lemmings, and it simply isn't worthwhile trying to talk to them until one can do it through a medium comparable in power to the media in the hands of the Jews. After I realized that, I addressed my message only to that portion of our people able to think independently of the masses. And even here, I was disappointed. I wrote and spoke about things of fundamental importance for the survival of our race and our civilization, and the response was minimal. That is, although many people agreed with me theoretically, very few were willing to do anything. In some cases, it was fear. They were afraid of the government, even though the government was much less fearsome in those days than it is now. More often, however, it was simply a lack of interest. People understood what I was saying, more or less, but their response was, "So what?" They were relatively comfortable and secure, and the things I was talking about seemed too impersonal, too remote. They didn't believe these things would impact their personal lives severely enough to warrant their taking action along the lines I suggested. I told them about the Jewish control of the mass media, and most of them believed me because I gave them names and other specifics they could check for themselves. I told them that allowing the Jews to exercise such power over our people would lead to our destruction. They shrugged and figured I was exaggerating. They thought that they would control what their own kids watched on TV, and that would take care of the problem. No need to do anything drastic. Well, I kept preaching, and I continued to develop new media for my message. Radio, the internet, music, video. The response to my message grew, but very slowly. I tried every way I could to stress the importance of what I was saying. I used very emphatic language, sometimes shocking language. I didn't want to risk losing credibility by exaggerating, but I did try hard to catch people's attention and make them think about what I was saying. And I did more than just talk and publish. One subject I had preached long and hard about from the beginning was the danger of the United States continuing to provide military, financial, and diplomatic support for the gangster state of Israel. I warned that supporting Israel was not in accord with America's interests, that it was only making the people from whom we needed to purchase petroleum hate us, and we were getting nothing in return from Israel except contempt. Indeed, I put a great deal of effort into publicizing Israel's treacherous attempt in 1967 to sink the U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty, and kill the crew so that it could be blamed on Egypt, against whom Israel was waging war at the time. Then in 1973, when Israel was involved in another war against both Egypt and Syria, I sued the U.S. Secretary of Defense in a federal court in an effort to block the illegal shipment of U.S. tanks, aircraft, and other weapons to Israel. I invited others to join me in this lawsuit. This was a concrete thing people could do. If the United States could be made to stay out of the war, then Israel would lose, and our Jewish problem in the Middle East would be solved. But in order to be effective, my lawsuit needed much support. It needed some big names behind it so that the media couldn't ignore it. It needed a whole army of high-profile lawyers prosecuting it so that the courts couldn't ignore it. And the lawyers meant money, of course. The suit itself was on firm legal ground. The Secretary of Defense could not legally send U.S. tanks and planes to Israel without specific authorization from the Congress, which he did not have. And the Jews needed the weapons immediately in order to avoid defeat by the Egyptians and the Syrians. Well, the big names I wanted to associate with my lawsuit refused to come forward. They were much more concerned with not offending the Jews than with eliminating the festering sore in our side that was Israel. And neither the money nor the high-profile lawyers needed to make the federal court pay attention to my suit came forward. And so the Jewish Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, airlifted to Israel the weapons for which the Jews were clamoring. He drew down our military stockpiles in Europe to dangerously low levels in order to give Israel the weapons needed to defeat her neighbors. All of this was in the middle of the Cold War, when the U.S. defense of Western Europe against the Soviet Union was a serious matter. The Congress later gave Schlesinger the authorization to do what he had done after the fact. But when he began doing it, he lacked that authorization, and a strongly prosecuted lawsuit could have delayed the shipment of arms to Israel. I had put all of my own money into the effort to hold up the diversion of U.S. weapons to Israel at least long enough to give an advantage to Egypt and Syria, and no one would help me. Anyway, for my efforts, I had a valuable lesson in the way the judicial system works in America. It's not about justice and right and the law. It's all about power and money. I also had yet another reminder of what I already had learned about the lack of any real sense of responsibility, even among thinking Americans. I'm sure that many of those who refused to help me with my lawsuit in 1973 thought of themselves as patriots. They just didn't take seriously my warning about the dangerous consequences for America of continuing to permit the U.S. government to support Israel's aggression against her neighbors.
You've been listening to Dr. William Luther Pierce, part one of our two-part series, All His Waking Hours, detailing his monumental efforts to save white Americans and white people around the world from the curse of Jewish domination. Be sure and keep your eye on our Cosmotheist bookstore at cosmotheistchurch.org. That's cosmotheistchurch, all one word, .org, for a brand new CD, The Power of Truth, Volume 10, with over 20 of Dr. Pierce's complete speeches, remastered and presented on one CD. It should be ready a few days after you hear these words. And remember also, you can be a part of Dr. Pierce's efforts right now in 2020. You can join our community of consciousness, our community of the most worthwhile work you've ever experienced in your life. Dr. Pierce will continue this story for us next week, right here on American Dissident Voices.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil.